The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back. As we head into hour three, it's a delight to have in studio one of my favorite people in the world, and certainly in Arizona. He and his family are tied to Arizona inseparably, and that is Congressman John Shattuck. He represented Arizona's old 4th Congressional District for many, many years, and is now the head of Shattuck Associates, where he does legal and political and other kinds of governmental interference consulting. Is that a good way to put it? Government intervention, interference consulting? Yeah.
The government today is so massive that it interferes with businesses on a pervasive scale constantly, whether it's city government interfering with businesses, county government interfering with businesses, state government or federal government. They're just constantly harassing kind of the business du jour. And so a lot of people who have not been in that position before have no concept of how to deal with a business or how to deal with a bureaucracy or the bureaucrats who are harassing them. And having been on the inside, I have some perspectives about that. And so, occasionally a business will reach out to me and say, look, we're dealing with the XYZ agency and they want us to do A, and it makes no sense. It'll cost us a huge amount of money and it won't accomplish anything. And so my job is to figure out, you know, what's the basis for what the government's doing, and can it be persuaded that it's taking a position that is silly or stupid or unwise or too expensive, and or can we find some middle ground here so the business can go on employing its employees and producing its products?
You you raise a couple questions I want to follow up with on just that very brief intro, if I might. First of all, just as an interesting thing, you and I, who kind of grew up in the 80s with the political conservatism of Ronald Reagan, and indeed in his first inaugural, he said something very close to the effect that government isn't the solution, it's the problem. And the corollary to that was more free enterprise, more business. And the conservative movement and the Republican Party generally towed that line. Kind of interesting to see over the last 15, 20 years, and with rapid acceleration in the last 5 or 6 years, John Shattuck, that business and corporate entities seem to have really been aping and mocking the bureaucracy of the government rather than the other way around. They haven't shown the way to easy so much as shown that they are very good at engaging in their own form of bloat. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Absolutely.
As well. Big is bad, it turns out, whether it's government or private.
I think big is, in fact, bad in the corporate world. And we saw this even back when I was serving in Congress from 94 to 2011. The tendency of large businesses to want to profit by eating from the government trough.
Yeah.
What we called crony capitalism was very, very prevalent when I got to Washington and started serving in 1995. And one of the things my freshman class was very interested in and aggressive on was crony capitalism, the government doing favors for big influential businesses. My clients don't fit in that category. My clients are all... maybe with one exception, pretty darn small businesses. And, public employees appropriately want to accomplish something, but often they abuse their power. Often the underlings abuse the power and the elected officials are unaware of it or don't pay enough attention to it. And sometimes, you know, we hear this pretty often. The government creates a problem and then the government steps in and solves it.
They create a problem in order to fund or find a solution. Sure.
Exactly.
Right.
And in some of my in the instance of some of my clients, I discover after I get involved, they may have been defended by a traditional lawyer. And in some cases, they've even gone through a judicial proceeding.
Yeah, right.
And the government lawyer says, you know, I went through a judicial proceeding and I didn't win or I lost or I'm afraid I'm going to lose. And that's when they decide, well, maybe I should be looking for a different solution. And I come in and it is kind of fun when I discover, well, wait a minute, where did this problem start from? And you discover the government started it and the government doesn't now realize that it started the problem. So, you know, I think most of the players that I have dealt with are acting in good faith. Even when the government starts it, when I get involved, you discover the government is unaware that they started it. And so they are resistant to accepting any responsibility or participating in any resolution. So they say to the client, to the business, you know, well, you're doing this bad thing. You have to fix it. And oh, by the way, you have to pay the entire cost of fixing it. And in some instances, I've been able to trace it back and discovered, no, actually, you made this business do what somebody is now unhappy about. And you switched sides and decided to side with the public against this business. But what the business is doing is what you told them to do. And so suddenly they get reality. And sometimes I have in the past let the top bureaucrat involved know that I'm going to come in and I just want to meet with the elected officials and kind of explain the issue to them. And what happens is they go, well, why does he want to do that? And of course, because this is a litigation context, they say, well, you can't meet with my client without my lawyer there. And I say, fine, you can have your lawyer there. Not a problem at all. But in some instances, they've figured out, well, what does Mr. Shattuck want and what is he going to say to the elected officials for whom I work? And what they ultimately discover is that I'm going to point out to the elected officials that their staff created the problem.
Yeah.
And suddenly the staff, I was dealing with the city and I said to this city manager who had a staff, hey, I just want to come in and sit down one-on-one with the mayor and then each of the members of the city council and just chat with them about this problem. And he said, oh, sure, no problem. And a couple of days later, he calls me back and he says, you know, Mr. Shattuck, would you be open to trying to resolve this at the staff level before you meet with the mayor and the city council? And I said, oh, sure, I'd be happy to do that. And what he had figured out was that they had created the problem and that if I went to the elected officials and pointed them that out, the staff probably would have lost their jobs.
Yeah.
So they became much more amenable to a resolution. And pretty quick, we agreed on a compromise so they could solve the problem and it was done. So that's kind of fun. And it just comes from having seen government in some ways from the inside.
Sometimes there's a view, and I wonder how accurate it is, Congressman, that government at any level, obviously mostly at the federal, but then subsequently declining downward, has gotten so big and so massive that elected officials can't do that much anymore. Sometimes
Absolutely.
There's this view of stasis or sclerosis. Maybe the way college administrators look at students with the bureaucracy looking at the elected officials saying, well, we've been here for 10 years. We'll be here another 10. You're just visiting for a couple to four. Maybe there's some of that. But maybe just when you look at the Code of Federal Regulations, which is umpteen times larger than the U.S. Code itself,
right,
and churning out more regs every single day and obviously more people to enforce, apply, and deploy them. You wonder sometimes if when an elected official thinks he's steering the wheel on the ship, if it's actually connected to anything underneath and whether you can actually move ships when we talk about reforming government. Let me take a commercial break and have you respond to that on
you
the
bet.
Other side. John Shattuck is my guest, Shattuck Associates. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Congressman John Shattuck is my guest, S-H-A-D-E-G-G, in case you want to look up him or Shattuck Associates if you need help from him. John, I was just asking the point about, you know, you intervene with the government all the time. As an elected official, people make promises about reforming this, reforming that, streamlining this, streamlining that. And I'm just wondering if things have become so big and sclerotic that it's darn near impossible. There was one point in the 70s, I think it was proven untrue, but in one point in the 70s, toward the end of the Carter years, the columnists were writing things like the presidency is too big for any one man. Some one man tamed it, but you take the point.
Absolutely do I take the point. Not only do I take the point, I lived the point. It at the end of the day, when I left Congress, it was more than any other reason for me leaving, which was how little I could accomplish over time. Yeah, I was a very conservative member of the House, and I was trying. I looked at my goal every day as, okay, over there on the left side of the Republican conference, there are members of Congress in my party trying to drag the nation or the party to the left. And my job when I got up every morning was trying to drag the party to the right, try to return it to some of Senator Goldwater's principles or President Reagan's ideals, the founding fathers' beliefs. So I would, you know, I'd spend my day doing that. And I could see that I had an incremental effect, but I couldn't. There were many, many times when I'd tried to accomplish some specific thing in terms of passing perhaps good legislation, and you just could not get it done. In one instance, the daughter of a constituent had gone to the U of A, graduated, was working in Tucson. She came home from work one day and entered her apartment in downtown Tucson, and there was a man already in her apartment. He had broken in, and he raped her. And he was convicted and sentenced, but he died before the sentence was carried out. Well, what the family learned was that because he had been a veteran, he was entitled to all the accoutrements of having been a veteran. So that meant he got, and I don't remember these all precisely, so somebody can say, well, Shattuck, you missed this or you said this wrong. But basically, he got a plot at a military cemetery. He got a casket, but he also got a six-gun or seven-eight-gun salute, and he was entitled to have some members of the military band there, and he was entitled to have a folded American flag given to his family, and I don't remember all else, but the family of this young woman who had been brutally raped, and it turned out that same individual had raped other women and had murdered some of them, said this is an outrage.
Maybe not so much honor.
Right.
Should accrue. Should inure.
Right.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
He shouldn't get a lot.
Right.
So I told the family that I would not take away the financial benefits because that would punish the family. And the family, I didn't think, was necessarily at fault for his conduct. So I said, I'm not going to take away the plot or write a bill to take away the plot or the casket or any of the things that, you know, would have put a burden on the family. But I said, you know, we could propose taking away, you know, the 21-gun salute or whatever he was entitled to, or the folded flag or the military band playing taps or whatever. So I wrote and introduced the bill. And it was interesting. It was after the Oklahoma City bombings where they had already enacted some provisions like this that had taken away some accoutrements.
Right, right, because of Tim McVeigh and those guys. Right, right.
Because
right.
it was a murder.
Right.
Well, long story short, first year the bill seemed to be moving fine. I was happy about it. It was going somewhere. And all of a sudden, right before the end of the session, it died. And I asked, well, why? And they said, gosh, we don't know. We just didn't have time to get to it. Second session that I introduced it, exact same story. Gosh, we just didn't have time to get to it. Third session where I introduced it, same excuse. And it suddenly dawned on me that this was an old boys club that didn't want to give any take any additional accoutrements away from a new class of people. In this case, it would have been veterans who had committed rape. And so they were shining me on, and the bill wasn't ever going to go anywhere. So it only took me three sessions of congressman, which means 6 years, to kind of figure out I was being
on something that doesn't seem like it's moving the world.
It seemed to me like a reasonable request.
Right.
Long story short, I found a woman on the Rules Committee. Happened to be a Democrat woman on the Rules Committee. And I told her the story that the old boys club at the Veterans Committee was making sure this bill would never pass. So she introduced it in the Rules Committee, which you can do. And I'm not even sure today. I think it passed the House. It might have been pulled and not passed the House, but I think it passed the House and then died in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, lots of things in Congress are not logical as you would expect. And when you talk about people with power, I'm sure the committee chairman didn't want this to happen. They ultimately pretty much admitted that to me. And they said, well, this is the, in legislative terms, people have heard it called the camel's nose under the tent. Mm-hmm. And they were concerned that if they expanded it from murder, as they had done in the McVeigh Oklahoma City bombing, to include rape, who knows what right. might come next. And they didn't want to start the trend.
Yeah.
And I had to figure out a way to get around them. And quite frankly, I left Congress before it ever became the law of the nation. And I don't think it is now.
So interesting. And when I say it, and this isn't something that moves the world, I didn't mean it in any sense to diminish the case. What I meant is this isn't some big HHS thing. This isn't some big Department of Defense.
This isn't funding the entire government.
Yeah. This is
we're creating the.
Yeah, this is something you would
Department
think
of
a
space
congressman
warfare.
Could do. All right, you're being asked to write a couple of books, as I understand it, and I want to flesh some of that out with you on the other side of this break, if we can, because I would for
good
one,
by me and huh? asked maybe. The question is, maybe I'm the person asking myself, but then other people say,
well,
yeah,
I'll
you
ask
should
you.
Do that.
I'm good at asking questions. I'll ask you. If they haven't been asked, and I think they have been, I'll reiterate. John Shattuck and I will be right back. Well, welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Congressman John Shattuck was just asking me about the music we went out in the last break with Neil Diamond. We have special pleadings here. If it's Neil Diamond, it's usually as a request of the Honorable Justice Bill Montgomery. That's what he likes. If it's Bob Dylan,
I happen to agree with Bill.
Yeah. If it's Bob Dylan, it's going to be our mutual friend Steve Twist. If it's trumpet, like we just came in with, like Harry Connick Jr.'s band, it's usually because once in a while they let me have my way. That's how it works around here.
Well, then I'll start putting in regular requests.
You can put in a request, yes.
And my request will be for Garth Brooks.
Oh, we can do Garth. We used to have some Garth Brooks. The Sands of the Beaches of Cheyenne, I believe, was one of them. I love Garth Brooks. He really – are you a country music guy, John?
Yes. I have become a country music guy over time.
Yeah, he really rejuvenated it.
Yeah.
He and Randy Travis, I think, like no other in the 90s, really late 80s, really rejuvenated a kind of what was kind of country western, moving into a bit of a bit more modern. But then they took it, they made of it, you know, a whole new big thing, as did the ladies of country. Like
I just
Shania
think Garth Brooks is talented, and there are several of his songs that I just absolutely love.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is The Dance.
Yes, of course.
But the other one is Friends in Low Places.
Yes.
I think
it's a great song to sing in a group.
Here we go. I'll embarrass Senator John Kyle.
Okay.
Or maybe I really won't embarrass him. The first John Kyle fundraiser I ever went to pretty much blew my socks off because then Congressman, now former U.S. Senator John Kyle, stood up in front of the group himself and played and sang Friends in Low Places.
Oh, wow.
And he's good.
Is he?
Yeah, he was really very good. And it turned out, now I'm going to tell stories and get in trouble. Kyle used to be with a big Phoenix law firm, and they would every year hike one of the mountains in the White Mountains with the newcomers to the law firm, the freshman lawyers, and camp out somewhere up the mountain, and Kyle would play the guitar and sing songs.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything close to that since Jim. Do you remember Jim Woolsey, former CIA director?
Yep.
His retirement, he invited me to. We used to be pretty close. And the whole night long, he sang Johnny Cash songs. That was it. Yes.
Well, one thing, too, I think a lot of people think of Senator Kyle as slightly formal or stiff.
Yeah.
And yet this John Kyle, who would go camping with the young lawyers in his firm and play the guitar and sing with them, shows you that, you know, he's really kind of a down-to-earth guy.
Yeah.
I announced to run against him in that race because I wanted to send the signal that I, even though I was Steve Shadegg's son, I didn't want to spend my life just being a campaign manager. I wanted to get the word out that you ought to be thinking about me as a candidate. And I knew I wanted to run for Congress. And I knew when I jumped into the race that I had no intention of staying. It was already crowded with Kyle and Mark Diagardi and John Conlon, and there was no chance that I could beat John Kyle's, but I just wanted to make this marker. I'm not just going to spend my life as a campaign manager. So the minute I dropped out, which was long before the primary, it might have been early June, I announced I wasn't going to stay in the primary. Kyle invited me to come be a part of his kitchen cabinet that met regularly, and we got in an intense debate. His consultant, and Kyle may call me and tell me I shouldn't be talking out of school, but I think it's a cute story. His consultant, who was from out of town, and the rest of the steering committee were debating a hot issue about, I think, Senator Kyle's first brochure or second brochure. And the question was, should we put into that brochure a photograph from John's early years where he had a 4-H cow and he had groomed the cow and then shown it and done quite well. And he was from Iowa, I think I want to say, in any event, and he had this farming background. And the consultant was adamantly against it. He said, no. John Kyle is a 3-piece suit lawyer and we're not going to put any picture in a John Kyle brochure of him showing a cow when he was in high school. And I fought the other side, and we won.
I would have been.
And that brochure had a picture of Senator Kyle with his 4-H cow.
I would have been with you on that. I like the cowboy imagery.
At the end of the day, the consultant and I would go toe to toe on every issue.
Yeah.
And then Senator Kyle and Bob Robb would go into the back room, and the two of them would decide which one of us won the day.
All right. When we come back, we're talking about your next book. John Shadegg is my guest. We'll be right back. See, that, John, would be one of the songs I got to get in.
There you go.
That is a young Wayne Newton performing, probably at the age of 12 or 13, sounding a little feminine because I don't think his voice had broken yet.
Deep Arizona Ties.
Yeah, Deep Arizona Ties. But that horn, that blasting horn that's coming in is an old Trumper passed away by his own hand, unfortunately, in the late 70s, named Bud Brisbois. The reason I mention that, and I like it not only because of his tremendous, what we say, chops, that tremendous ability, is that in the last years of his life, he sat in at Mesa Community College's jazz ensemble to help teach kids. And I just thought, you know, that's a neat thing to do. You know, they had a great jazz program down there. And can you imagine to be able to be a student and play with a virtuoso like that? In any event, let me not be distracted by by the business that is in its grave before us. There are a few books people want you to write. I know this to be a fact. There's a few movies some people want you to make. Your dad wrote the most important campaign book ever, How to Win an Election. And perhaps a reworking of it might be in the offing, or perhaps with a new introduction by John Shadegg with some edits. Maybe that's a thought. But also, John, the ratings Congress gets these days, you know, there's the old joke, everyone thinks their congressman is great, but Congress as a whole is somewhere below, I don't know, below zero sometimes.
Below used car sales.
Yeah, just as bad as it gets. Maybe a book like What's Wrong with Congress or How to Reform Congress. I mean, someone like you who is a reformer from the conservative, a lot of these books get written by the liberal Brookings Institute types. Maybe we could use one from a conservative type.
Well, it's a thought that I've toyed with for a long time. The idea of rewriting How to Win an Election has been on my mind and urged by a number of people who know that book for many, many years. As I've come to have more time to work on campaigns, and my son has worked on a couple of campaigns on his own, a congressional campaign in California and a United States Senate campaign in Oregon, you begin to see what the business is like. By that, I mean the business of consulting or managing campaigns, how, you know, what the negatives are, and quite frankly, the negligence of some of the people who hold themselves out as experts today and who make tragic, inexcusable mistakes. In the Oregon Senate campaign, the consultant for a U.S. Senate campaign apparently did no opposition research on the incumbent Democrat senator. And no, you can call it opposition research on his own candidate. And you need to do both. You got to find out what skeletons are in your opponent's closet.
What they'll bring out.
And what skeletons are in your client's closet. And in this case, the opposing incumbent candidate aired a story which portrayed the Republican candidate as, and it was a woman, as having stalked a boyfriend, and there was a police report. And after the story had broken, she called me and we talked, and she said, well, opposition research wouldn't have revealed this. Even if they'd done op research on me, they couldn't have found it. And I was stunned by that explanation. It's only an explanation you could hear from a freshman candidate. She, by the way, was literally an infant neonatal brain surgeon. I mean, this lady did not lack for any brains. So, but she said to me on the phone, she said, well, Congressman, they would not have ever found the story they aired had they tried to do research. And I said, well, if your campaign consultant couldn't have found it out about you, how did the other side find it out?
Yeah.
And that kind of knocked her back.
Yeah.
And she ultimately admitted that the night it had occurred, she had a boyfriend and they had broken up, and she really liked this guy. So she went over to his house. He ultimately filed a police report. He refused to file a police report, but he had, on the night of the incident, called the police, and they showed up after she had left, and he told them the story, and then he said, you know, I don't want to file a police report, and so they didn't file one. And she and the guy later kind of got back together, and he said, you know, I talked to him and sent him away. So neither one of them thought there was any police report filed. But police don't go visit a house and not
correct
and not report what they're doing.
Right.
You know, so I'm sure the report said we interviewed so and so. He was concerned about what his former girlfriend
was
doing.
So there was no witness statement, but they filed a report.
And,
yeah,
and we talked to him, and he said he didn't want to file a complaint, and he never did file a complaint. Yeah. But by checking the records of the local police department, his her opponent or her opponent's consultants and managers found the story.
All right. So note to everyone listening, if you're running for office, check police reports.
And more basic than that, do opposition research on your opponent to find out what there is there, and do the same on yourself. And a lot of people will say, well, like Steve Largent refused to run any negative campaigns because he thought, you know, there's been time when people debate negative campaigning. And he managed to lose the governor's office in Oklahoma after he left Congress because he wouldn't run what he called negative campaigns. In my view, and I think it's pretty well, very clearly defined in my dad's book. One is you have to give people reasons to vote for you, and you have to give the voters reasons to vote against your opponent. And some people say, well, saying anything about why you should vote against your opponent, so that does that mean if your opponent is a big spender and has caused the jurisdiction in which he or she has served in the past to blow the budget and go into debt, are you not supposed to say that because that's negative? So my definition of negative campaigning is, number one, it is in every instance negative campaign if it's a lie.
Yeah.
So if you tell a lie about your opponent,
that's negative.
That's negative campaigning. And the second category that my dad talks about in his book is if it's not pertinent to the office. So for example, if your opponent's wife has a drinking problem or her brother has a drinking problem, well, neither of those are pertinent to how well you will do the job. So if you surface that, my dad's definition is that's negative campaign. But if the information is accurate or truthful and it reflects on how well you can do the job, or whether you do the job the way the voters want it done, then
here's the best book you could write, John. Run Again. John Shattuck has been my guest. Thank you, John Shattuck. Always lovely seeing you, sir. Delighted to be your friend.
Thank you for having me here.
You bet.
I enjoy it.
Portions of this show brought to you by our good friends at YRefi. YRefi offers up a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio, and it's not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve, and you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return with YRefi. They also invest with you a lot of flexibility and control. You can turn your income on or off. You can compound it, whatever you like, and with YRefi, there are absolutely no fees and there is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. Of course, you get a monthly statement with no surprises, and you can even visit them in person. They're based here locally on Chauncey Lane in North Phoenix. If you do, you won't get a sales pitch. You won't be asked to sign a thing. They leave that up to me. Check them out if you don't see them in person at investyrefi.com. That's the word invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-YREFI-24, 888-YREFI-24. I was thinking about that. Government isn't the solution, it's the problem line, and the conversation with John about, you know, the sclerosis, the sclerotic nature of moving the dial in any direction with government. And it always takes me back to the intro in the Screwtape Letters of C.S. Lewis's, where he writes, "The greatest evil is not done now in those sordid dens of crime that Dickens loved to paint. It is not even done in concentration camps and labor camps. In those we see their final result. But it is conceived and ordered, moved, seconded, carried, and minuted in clear, carpeted, warm, and well-lit offices by quiet men with white collars and cut fingernails and smooth-shaven cheeks who do not need to raise their voice." Never need to raise their voice. You'll never know who they are. That's the bureaucracy. That's the deep state. How did I learn about that quote? One, from reading the Screwtape Letters. Not initially, anyway. I learned it because Ronald Reagan used to quote it often. In fact, it's in his Evil Empire speech. And that is where I believe so much of the evil does come. It comes from the people we never hear about, never see, are not accountable, and have to be made accountable. Let me thank you, Bill, for sitting in today. It's good to have the old band back together, at least the old duet. And we will wish young David fine fettle for tomorrow. I'm Seth Leibson. Thanks for being with us. God bless you all, and class dismissed.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.